Hello and welcome to the Lebanese Politics Podcast. I'm Benjamin Red, joined as always by Nizar Hassan. Nizar, it's done. Khalas.
Finally.
The elections are over. We're coming to you. This is the last episode that we have in this limited series that we came back for. And today we're going to be talking about the elections, what happened with the vote, and what does that mean?
Yeah, so Sunday we had the big vote. Around 1,900,000 people voted. So that's a turnout rate of 49%.
Which is the same as before. I mean, initially we were getting these numbers and it sounded like turnout had actually gone way, way down. But apparently, and I think it was Richard Salemme at Laureate Today who figured this out. There was some issue with the numbers that the Interior Ministry was putting out. And it turns out now it was 49%, which is the same as last time, basically the same as 2009 as well.
Yeah, it's not a great voter turnout by international standards or by democratic standards in general. You know, half of the population chose not to vote in this election. We also had 1% of the population that voted blank, and that's around 9,000 people. And we have a bigger, much bigger number of votes that were cancelled because of an error in how people filled them, or sometimes people were sending messages rather than actually voting, putting, you know, all sorts of drawings and symbols on people's faces, etc. But we have around 57,000 of those, so 3% of the votes that were cast were actually cancelled, even when it's an honest mistake, which is a huge portion of that. When I was a Mandoob back in 2018, sitting in the polling station, most of the cancelled votes were honest mistakes, like people using a bigger check sign than they should, or putting a circle instead of that, or whatever. It's clear what they're trying to do, just vote for this guy. But because these symbols might give a reference to the candidates and the parties that this person voted for them or not, they are not allowed and the votes are cancelled.
Yeah, and that goes partially, at least this time around, to a sort of a lack of voter education, which is something that was actually called out this week. The European Union, they had this observer mission for the elections, and they released a preliminary report. One of the things that they said in this report, and there was quite a bit in the preliminary report. One of the things, though, was that, oh, well, there wasn't any good voter education really done. I mean, it's not too difficult to, you know, fill out the ballots, but still you need to know this is what you do and this is what you can't do. If you do this, your ballot, your vote is not going to count.
Yeah, the EU addressed the government saying there wasn't enough political education. At the same time, usually actually this political education happens by the representatives of parties that sit outside of the voting stations. So usually you would go there and they would tell you the instructions. So many people have pointed out to me that these people, the electoral machines, weren't trained enough this time and weren't doing this professional part of their work well, which led a lot of their own supporters to vote cancelled votes.
An own goal, yeah.
Yeah. And another lack of training was at the level of the election staff. The EU pointed that out in the report as well. Not all the election staff were trained enough to manage the process. There were many procedural errors. Even setting up the room, you know, where you vote, it's very tricky because it might be exposed to some people. And it was the case in, you know, a few or many actually polling stations.
On a happier note, though, they did say that electricity was pretty good. I think they said like only one of the counting stations had electrical problems or something. But most of the report was actually quite critical. You know, they talked about back in 2018, they also had an observer mission and they made like 25 recommendations or something like that. And none of them had been implemented whatsoever. And other than that, though, I mean, this is a preliminary report. It said a lot of things that we already know. It talked about the media, for instance, and how the media was biased. They didn't give, you know, any sort of equitable airtime. Connected to the media issue is the one of financing. There are rules about financing in the election, but the Electoral, you know, Supervisory Commission doesn't really, they don't have the tools to be able to actually control any of this. You know, you have banking secrecy in the country, which is a huge thing, which means, you know, people can do things that, you know, and I'm saying, you know, a lot. You have banking secrecy in the country, for instance, that makes it harder to tell where finances are going. And then also just like a lot of it's done in cash.
In this economy, especially. Most of it's done in cash.
Right, the banks don't work.
Yeah, which means they are not traceable, just to be clear. So literally, we have no way of monitoring. The government has no way of monitoring and actually saying who violated this campaign finance law or not under the current circumstances.
And the Observer mission pointed out that the supervisory commission, this one that is supposed to be, you know, looking over and making sure everybody follows the rules, it lacked funds, lacked qualified human resources, basic equipment, as well as an adequate mandate and sanctioning power, which is a pretty damning assessment, but a true one, I think, from everything that we've seen.
Indeed. And one of the things related to money, apart from campaign finance and overspending and paying for media appearances, etc., is straight out like clientelism and vote buying, which also the EU mentioned as a phenomenon that happened on a wide scale. They did not measure it, of course. They cannot measure it. But they're saying it was kind of a prominent phenomenon in these elections. And they mentioned that the bribes that were given to people, the in-kind bribes, apart from the money, include bread bags, which, by the way, in Tripoli, there were bread bags being distributed by the name of the candidate, Ihab Matar. That's one of the photos that I saw. Medical supplies, generators, and solar panels. I love that. there were news in the media. I cannot confirm them personally, that one of the candidates on Kataeb's list in Metin, Samir Saliba, distributed a large number of solar panels to a village in his constituency. Fuel. And I just want to mention a couple of things that have been reported by people on the ground in the last few days. For example, in the last few weeks, sorry. For example, having people at receptions at hospitals that pay out your fees when you can't.
And, oh, wow.
Yeah, that's a new form of bribery. Another one is actually going to schools and in your region and asking them, what do you need? Do you need any like fuel, any technology, any, you know, whatever supplies or anything we can give you, we can donate to you just because we love you, obviously. And this was done a lot in Metin as well. This is what I heard, as well as in Kisirwain and Jbeil. So bribery takes all sorts of creative forms in Lebanon.
Now, of course, the question here is how this does not necessarily mean that all of these investments by these candidates paid off, which is something we'll get into a little bit later.
Yeah.
But, you know, in West Beirut, where I live, for instance, there are all of this, it is known type things that, oh, Makhzoumi did this or that, you know, splashing money around. Suddenly there are street lights that are on the street that I live. And I heard, you know, that this was Makhzoumi. I don't know whether that's true or not, but that was the word going around the area. But he only got like one seat he ended up with. So it's a question as to how much these investments actually, do they have a payback? Do they have a payoff or not? Certainly there's a lot more that's going to be coming out. This was just a preliminary report. Also, I know LADE is very involved, the Lebanese Association for Democratic Elections. They're very involved in monitoring the elections and the entire process. And they usually have a report that comes out detailing everything, all of the violations. So I think we're going to see a lot more come from this, especially irregularities in the counting process, which is actually a very important question, because already we have candidates who are crying foul that something wasn't counted right, or this ballot box was disqualified when it shouldn't have been. And then there were tons of rumors going around on Sunday night and into Monday about politicians calling up judges or going to the Justice Palace to get, you know, this decision changed or what have you. So I'm very interested to see how this all plays out, both what we see from the report from LADE and any other organizations, and also just in court. I know I read Faisal Karami was planning a challenge up in Tripoli, potentially Jad Hossein maybe challenging the results. Is that right?
Yeah, it seems that I heard from Lucien Bourgeli that they're going to appeal. And one thing to mention here is that what you mentioned about politicians going to the Justice Palace, it was a very specific incident that happened this time, which is Melhem Riashi, the LF superstar in Metin, basically.
Former minister,
yeah.
Now an MP, will be an MP.
Yeah. And Rieshi went with a group of, you know, LF youth and stuff in a very intimidating scene to the Justice Palace when the news came out that the LF might lose its second seat, the seat of Razi Al-Hajj, because the news was that Riyad Ghusn is closer to winning that seat. And we had to wait long hours in that sense. And also what you mentioned about calling up the judge, I think what I heard was about Firzli. And there was this praise for the judge who kind of hung up on Firzli because she told him, like, you can't tell me what to do. I'm a judge. Like, you know,
have right. some saying, saying this to the deputy speaker of parliament is that's quite a bit. Yeah.
The former deputy parliament speaker now.
As of next week. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, all of that's going to be coming out and will be litigated most likely in the courts. And we may have, you know, runoffs. Remember, in 2018, there was an issue up in Tripoli over Dima Jumeli's seat, and they ended up going into a runoff. She won it. But we may have more of that. So the election might not actually be over.
Yeah. But apart from the irregularities of, like, the process itself, this election, like the previous one, showed us how specific and, you know, strange the electoral system is in terms of how it represents people. The EU report mentions that, quote, the district magnitude leads to significant differences in the ratio between voters and seats, which is inconsistent with the principle of equality of the vote. What this means is that in some districts, you need way more votes than in others in order to make it to parliament.
Absolutely. If you take the number of votes, the people who actually voted according to the Interior Ministry, and divide it by the number of seats in that district, you have something like 24,000 votes per seat in South 2, which is the Saida countryside, and Sur, Nabi Berri's home district, compared to roughly 6,000 votes per seat in East Beirut. The average across the country is about 15,000 votes per seat, at least in this election. And it's interesting, though, if you actually look at all of the constituencies, your vote matters least if you're voting in South 2, that's the district we just talked about, Akkar up in the north, and South 3, which is right next door, Marjayoun, Hasbaya, Bint Jubayl, Nabatiyeh. All three of those are historically underserved and underprivileged areas of the country.
Yeah, definitely. When you look at all sorts of socioeconomic indicators, you see that remote areas or areas close to the Syrian borders, like Akkar, like Hasbaya, as well as Baal Bakr Hilmer, to be clear, all of these have like very low socioeconomic indicators, and salaries are much lower. People's material, actual resources, are way lower than people in urban areas.
And per capita, they have fewer legislators to actually serve the area.
Yeah, exactly. This itself is a system that was created for sectarian reasons. It's not a coincidence that in South 2, which is a Shiite area, you have the highest threshold, which is, you know, 24,000. In East Beirut, which is, or Beirut 1, which is a majority Christian area, you have this reversed. So the system is trying to make sure that we get 50 Christian MPs, and geographically, the way they distributed them, gives some advantage to Christian areas that are more like pure Christian areas, and gives them more seats.
And this just goes back to demographic imbalance, where the Christians are, you know, by basically all surveys, Christians are now a minority, but they still, by law, should have 50% of the seats of parliament. Okay, so keeping all of that in mind, let's go ahead and look at, I think we should do it a little bit backwards. Instead of just saying, okay, this party got this many seats and they're the winner, why don't we start from just votes? How many votes, how many people do each of these lists and parties and movements have supporting them in this election? And if we look at it that way, we have Hezbollah coming out clearly on top with at least 330,000 voters supporting them, which is a big, you know, quite a strong popular mandate for them. Second off was actually quite a surprise. It's the change parties. It's these outsiders that were coming in. They had, it depends on how you count it. Megaphone has 246,000 voters voting for change parties across the country. Al-Akhbar has even more than that, like 330,000. But that includes a few other people like Osama Saad and Abdurrahman Bizri in Saida.
But by both sources, first comes Hezbollah and second comes the Change Bloc.
And then third, we have Amal with 175,000 votes. For everything else that one might say about Amal, they still have quite a bit of support. They're able to mobilize quite a bit of voters to go to the polls and vote for them. Then we have LF, which is about the same, about 175,000. Then fifth comes the Free Patriotic Movement with about 120,000 votes. And then various other parties, the PSP, for instance, has about 75,000 voters, according to Megaphone. So what's interesting here is not just this list of like the largest vote getters in the country, but also what changed from the last election. And here we can see Hezbollah actually increased its support by almost 20%. Obviously, the Change candidates who came out of nowhere, essentially, they only had one MP last time around. And this was the first election since October 17th, 2019, the Thawra. They obviously exploded. So I don't think the percent change really tells us anything. It's just a newcomer, right?
Yeah.
That was surprising, very surprising. The third place, Amal, they did lose votes. Not a whole lot, but 7%. The LF, meanwhile, gained about 18%, while the FPM, their Christian rivals, lost about 24% off of the vote totals of 2018. But now, going back to the actual electoral system and what does this translate into?
Here we see, like, the weird stuff.
Yeah. Hezbollah got the most votes, but how many seats did they get? 13.
Yeah. Compare that to the Lebanese forces, which got 19 seats for almost half the votes of Hezbollah.
Or the FPM, who got 18 seats for, like, a bit over a third of what Hezbollah got. Or we can look at the change parties themselves, which, they had, 250, maybe more than 300,000 votes, but that only translated into about 13 seats. Now, that's not quite an apples to apples comparison because the change, we'll talk about this in a minute, but it's not like they were all running on one list. So it was already fractured, so you'd expect that they would get fewer seats. But it is quite striking to see how the electoral system here translates actual votes on the ground into seats in Nejmi Square.
Yeah, and it's in that same sense, one story that's interesting is Kataib lost 23% of the preferential votes compared to 2018, but they gained a seat.
This is where the quirks of the electoral system come into play.
Yeah.
Especially for these smaller parties as well. And when you're talking about, seats around the edges.
And the reason we're not mentioning, when we're talking about the biggest parties that attracted votes, we're not talking about the Future Movement because it's not as a party. It wasn't running for elections. There were all sorts of ex-Future Movement figures running here and there. You can combine them and get to something like just over 100,000 votes. But it's different than when it's like a blue list across the country that, where you have data to actually compare with other lists, etc. Because in many areas, there were two Future Movement people competing with each other. So do you count both of them? And, it puts you in this tricky situation.
Right. And so if you do actually count up the winning Future candidates, you come to something like maybe eight or so people who either used to be Future Movement MPs and ran again, who got in or who ran along with them on some sort of list. But it's unclear exactly who those eight, like, are they going to form their own caucus or something? Probably not, it seems, at this point.
Yeah.
But we'll know in the coming days. But it's really a striking fall as well for the Future Movement. They went from winning something like 33 seats in 2009 down to 20 in 2018. And now officially they're zero, maybe eight if you want to call these MPs, future. But it really is just a shocking decline. But as opposed to 2018, this was actually done deliberately. Saad Hariri withdrew. So, you can't expect the Future Movement to figure in in any realistic sense to this parliament. But we'll talk a little bit more about that later.
Yeah, and the big news on everyone's minds after these elections, the most surprising, as you said, piece of news, although I have to give myself some credit because I made some wild predictions, not on air, to be clear. Don't go back to this episode and hold me accountable. I was making some wild predictions that we will get something between 10 and 15 MPs for the opposition. But seeing these numbers and looking at the details of how big the victory was in many places is quite, you know, fascinating.
Yeah, I thought you were crazy for thinking that high of numbers. I was thinking less than 10. Most likely they'll get a handful, but no, 13 seats from these movements. That's huge.
Yeah. And the results, you know, varied by area. The opposition didn't win in every single district. There are many places where they got zero seats, but there are a few places where they got more than one as well, which is like Beirut second, a big area for the opposition this year. They got 3 seats. In South Third, which is Nabatiyye, Bint Jbeil, Hasbaya, Marjayoun, opposition won 2 seats. This was a really big surprise because, you know, the talking point about no changes possible in Hezbollah's areas, etc. No, there was a change. And we'll talk about how significant it was in a second. But yeah, overall, it varied across districts. And let's try to kind of introduce, you know, who won? You know, who are these people?
We've got these 13 new MPs or about to become MPs, MPs elect, coming in, but they were on different lists from different parts of the country. And some of these lists, as we talked extensively on the program about, like, just because you're on the same list as somebody does not mean that you share anything in common with them. In fact, they might be your enemy, ideologically speaking and politically speaking. So who are these 13 people? Do they actually form a cogent block, or could they form a cogent block, or what?
Okay, it's hard to say because they haven't formed a block yet and they haven't made clear commitments. But what most of these candidates have said is that they would prefer, over any other option, to be in a change block. However, when you get to the details, you find there are significant differences when it comes to who these forces are allied with. One of the big victories in this election was Mark Dow in Alay. Mark Dow is the kind of like leader, de facto face of Taqaddum, not officially their president, but their main candidate. And the same party, Taqaddum, which is a liberal party, it calls itself a progressive party, but it's close to Kataib, and its economic policies are more liberal than social democrat or leftist. So we had two candidates winning from that party in the same district, Shouf Alay. One in Shouf and one in Alay, Mark Dow and Najat Saliba. And you had Wadah Sadiq in Beirut second, who was a very controversial choice. There were many divisions around whether to ally with him or not. Eventually, Wadah Sadiq made it to the list in Beirut second. He's from Anakhat Ahmar, a right-wing liberal group. Depending on what issue you're asking about, but it's a private business lobby, basically, or this is their main ideological position. Both Mark and Wadah, both Taqaddum and Anakhat Ahmar, were allies, official allies of Kataib in Jabhat al-Mu'arada, and they are, you know, the closest to Kataib in the Mu'arada, basically. So you have these three. If they don't form a change block, they might be going in a block towards Kataib and Kataib's own allies, which are many this time. Namat Frem, Michel Daher, perhaps Jean Talouzian, etc. Many people that might be close to the Kataib or willing to form a bloc with them. Other change MPs are more centrists to the left, if you want, more social democrats kind of discourses. So you have Brahim Naimne, who was running alongside Wadah Sadiq, but they have different discourses. Brahim Naimne is running for the third time. He ran for the municipality with Beirut Medinati in 2016 and then for the parliament under the umbrella of Kuluna Beirut in 2018 and now under this change list. And he actually got a very impressive number. He got 13,000 votes. And that makes him the second highest Sunni candidate in the country in terms of votes. And obviously the change MP with the highest number of votes in this election. Brahim Naimne is closer to groups like Mada, Lihaqi, etc., that are more on the left. Halima Qaqour, new MP in Shouf, specifically in Iqlim Kharroub, is also more towards like social democratic side. She is part of Lana Party, which calls itself a social democratic party. We have Firas Hamdan, who is close to Lihaqi as well. He's a lawyer and activist. who, by the way, got shot by security forces of the parliament on August 8th during the protests, and still apparently has a shrapnel in his heart from that.
This was in the aftermath of the Beirut port explosion, right?
Exactly. So Firas Hamdan won against the big controversial name in the election, maybe the most controversial candidate of all, Marwan Khairuddin, owner of Mawarid Bank and candidate supported by Talal Arslan and Jumblatt from the Druze side and Amal and Hezbollah from the Shia side on the biggest, most, you know, powerful list in South 3. But he lost. People didn't vote for him. People didn't appreciate that he was a candidate in the first place. And Firas Hamdan got way more votes than him. So Firas Hamdan made it to parliament, and he is one of the people who are clearly aligned against, like, banks' interests, against neoliberal policies, etc.
Wasn't his first act after learning to, like, go run out and meet with the depositors' union?
Yeah, and make a statement also not only about the depositors, but also about rejecting the selling private assets to pay back the banks. So yeah, that was a good start. And we have Ilyas Jradi, who was supported by the Communist Party and others in South 3 as well. He got a lot of votes. He got 9,000 votes. And, you know, it's not clear what his ideological, you know, position is, but he seems more he seems to be more likely to be on the left than the right, especially that he's supported by the Communist Party. So these are more the left-leaning people who will not ally with, like, Kataeb or Namat Fremd. It's very unlikely. Then you have the more centrist or ideologically not very clear people. You have Paula Yaoubian and Cynthia Zarazir, both winning in Beirut 1, and both not very ideological. Cynthia Zarazir was also another very controversial candidate because of a tweet she made back in 2016, I think, calling for the extinction of the Syrian people. And yeah, jeez. It's crazy. Yeah. And then she didn't defend her position, but she said, you know, I don't regret it because I only regret generalizing and I don't regret the message. And it's very shameful that someone like that can be accepted in a change block before she actually seriously apologizes for this and say clearly that, no, I was wrong. I was speaking like a crazy fascist and I should not have said these words. And I apologize to the Syrian people or every Syrian who read my message. You know, something like that actually has value. Not saying, no, I don't regret it. I didn't word it well. No, it's not about the phrasing. It's about the intention of, you know, genocide. Another person who's not clear ideologically, Melhem Khalaf.
The former head of the Bar Association here in Beirut.
Yeah, Melhem Khalaf was not particularly very popular among activists in these elections, but he did have enough votes to make it. You also have Michel Dwehi, who is a centrist, but a more political, more ideological, but in the center or the liberal side. It seems that he will not be soft on the banks, which is good. But more than that, I cannot really judge what his alliances will be yet. I haven't spoken to him, and I'm not sure. It's his first time in parliament, and we'll see. And there are two other candidates that we really cannot categorize here. Rami Finj, a philanthropist and Thawra figure in Trablus, and Yassin, who is from Biqa Gharbi, he won with the Sahluna Wal Jabal list, who has made conservative comments about not supporting any law that contradicts the Islamic Sharia. You know, quite disappointing to hear, because that's a lot of laws that we're going to be proposing or we've been demanding from parliament. So he's not in favor of a civil marriage law or a person status law, these things that make secularism or the idea of less sectarian society possible. Also, many policies related to women he might be standing against. So yeah, we have a cocktail of candidates, not all from the same ideological place, and not all, like, have the same alliances or strategy at all, because they were elected independently in these different areas without a lot of coordination.
Right. It sounds like it would be difficult to actually form a cohesive group from these new MPs based on what you just told me. I mean, I know if I were one of these MPs, I would not want to be in a block with somebody who called for the extermination of a people. There are some very basic differences between these candidates, and some of them are quite wide gulfs, especially when you're talking about, you know, sectarianism and stuff like that. I mean, my question would be, why are they even a change candidate or a change?
Yeah. And Waddah Sadiq, the one who we spoke about, who is more right-wing, is a very questionable guy in terms of his relations to Saad al-Hariri, the money he's made through Match 14 advertising, etc. But apart from that, he's made some comments recently, like supporting the idea that we need a dictatorship in Lebanon, you cannot trust democracy anymore, the idea that he would fight any law to legitimize homosexuality. I don't know what that means. But yeah, he's also like against pushing for a civil marriage law in Lebanon. Because why do we need it? People can just go to Cyprus. Yeah, everyone can go to Cyprus. Waddah, that's such a great idea. يعني, I don't know why people don't do it every day. Maybe because Waddah hasn't told them that they can, right?
Oh, you just got to go down to the bank, withdraw fresh dollars, which is super easy to do.
Of course.
I'm sure everybody has it. And the banks are working just fine. And then go and purchase a ticket to Cyprus and go get civil married.
That's... Yeah. Very, very cheap. Book a hotel. I did that. You know how much I paid? Like $2,000. Who, like, really, like half of the Lebanese population probably doesn't have $2,000 in savings right now. What are you talking about? Anyway, it's not so exciting to see so much difference in values between candidates, especially on the same list. But at the end of the day, the opposition looked at the electoral law from a strategic or tactical point of view, looked at the seats specifically from that point of view. And each group, each moneyed interest, each whatever, was trying to support their candidate rather than the list in general. There are organizations that were supporting lists in general and a huge network of people in the diaspora that mobilized with common lists across Lebanon. But generally on the ground, how it happened is individuals who want to run for elections. And sometimes, by the way, these individuals form parties, you know, to give them a platform. Like Paula Yaoubian has Tahaluf Watani. Tahaluf Watani was not Paula's platform, but it became so after... It kind of dissolved after the 2018 election. Mark Dow and Najat Saliba have Taqaddum. Halima Qaqour has Lana, etc. So you see, these parties are not populist at all, barely have any participants or members. At the same time, they were created for the sake of kind of supporting and legitimizing a certain candidate. So politics in the opposition today remains individualistic to up to a great extent. And that's going to be a challenge on how to build on this victory in the next 4 years if you want to have a bigger victory next time, if your framework is up to these individuals and what decisions they make rather than like a few, two or three parties or institutions that sit together and decide either we're allying together in this election and these are our candidates or we're not. This is not this infrastructure. It's all up to these figures and celebrity politicians.
And the opposition groups that actually do have something of a party structure, or it's not just around a single person or one person doesn't dominate. You do have Shemeluna, which there was one successful candidate, Michel Douahi, up in Zgharta, that won. But the other one that probably a lot of people are thinking about is Mumfid.
Yeah.
From Shabul Nahas, but they actually had a full sort of party structure running in all of these districts across Lebanon, and literally nobody won from the list.
Yeah, nobody won, and in places where they were running alone, they had a very small share of the votes. And it's so, like, I'm not gonna go into like a Memphis analysis right now, but it says a lot about the difference between politics based on the intent and the spectacle, and politics based on real people on the ground. Memphis is an initiative supported and promoted by a certain middle class, but it's not a middle class that lives in the social fabric in Lebanon today. It's not the people who are active on the ground in networks for the last 10 years. These are mostly newcomers, mostly diaspora people supporting this party. So it's more about like proving that we can do this rather than having a strategy of winning anywhere. And even during the election, they were saying things like, we're not trying to win seats, we're trying to have a national survey on our program. Then what I felt in that moment was like, okay, then I support your program. I think their program is great, especially on the economic and financial side, but I will not vote for you because that's a wasted vote, because you're not asking people to actually vote for you enough, and people will go vote for the most powerful change list in their district. And I kind of, I'm glad I did that, you know. Memphis knows that I appreciate their program, but beyond that, one vote to their survey is not going to make much difference. But so many votes given to a change list in one of the areas can actually bring in new people to parliament who might be able to fight one or two fights. I'm not saying they're going to be great. I'm not saying I trust Najat and Mark and everyone to be my representatives in parliament. But I'm saying, like, yeah, that's a useful vote in a way.
Yeah, and it is so early now. We really don't know how things are going to play out, whether these 13 MPs are going to band together and form some bloc, or whether they're going to split up along ideological lines or some other lines. But it is, I think, interesting. Number one, 13 seats out of 128. Sure, it doesn't seem that big, but that is actually, in Lebanese politics, that is a sizable block if they are able to make it. And theoretically, if they are able to come together and be a cohesive block in some sense, they may be able to affect policy somewhat. I'm not entirely sure the extent of that, especially if they try for very big aims. You know, they'll just get slapped down. But it is possible, at least theoretically, that they could start to have some sort of impact on the way Lebanon is governed.
And one thing about the parliament is that you need 10 MPs to sign on a draft law in order to propose it. You need one MP to initiate and 10 MPs to sign on it. So you already have them. If you have a block of change MPs, then whatever you want to propose as a law to parliament, you can immediately propose it with the signature.
It doesn't mean it'll get a vote, but you can propose it.
Oh yeah, Nabibri will make sure to decide who gets the votes.
And so we talked a little bit about like the economic policy differences between them, but also there is a question about, you know, Hezbollah's weapons, which was a really big talking point during the campaign this year. And it's not entirely clear that everybody's on the same page within these 13 newcomers on that either. So I think that this, though, goes into the larger discussion of March 8th versus March 14th, which was a really big thing that was being teased. There were sort of fear-mongering campaigns that March 8th is going to get 2/3 of parliament, which will allow them to, you know, basically do whatever they want. In the end, it did not happen that way at all. The way the numbers actually shake out is it's roughly 50-50. It's very difficult to tell exactly who has, at least for me, to tell exactly who has a majority between March 14th and March 8th. First off, because these groups don't exist in the same way that they used to begin with. But then also you've got sort of this fracturing of blocks. You have, in general, sort of smaller blocks in parliament and then a lot more independents. We don't know yet which block they're going to be a part of and whether that block would be more towards the March 8th side or more towards the March 14th side. So, I mean, really, Nizar, you and I were counting things up both yesterday and today before recording, and it seems as though both sides have 60-something MPs.
Yeah, but neither side has an easy absolute majority. No way.
So really, it comes down to a question of, well, when you ask the question, March 8th or March 14th, what do you mean by that? What specific policies are you talking about? Because it might hinge on that.
Yeah, but one thing that did happen, a clear pattern that happened, if you look at the election results, is the loss of many people and many parties and figures associated with the Syrian regime. These figures were central to March 8th's majority last time, if you remember. Even when we were discussing it last time, I remember 4 years ago, we were thinking about how real is this whole March 8th, March 14th thing, but we were acknowledging that there are a number of figures whose allegiance is directly to the Syrian regime, as it's known in Lebanese politics, which makes them clearly on one side rather than the others. Many of these are gone now. I'll give you examples. Talal Irslan, most loyal supporter of the Syrian regime among the Druze leaders, gone. Karami, Faisal Karami, gone. SSNP, the Syrian Social Nationalist Party, it used to have 3 MPs. Now it's gone.
Completely wiped out.
Wiped out, and the votes they got were not, you know, were not something to brag about. Ali Fizli, deputy parliament speaker, perhaps the closest to the Syrian regime. And we talked about him 4 years ago and we were saying, look at this. Ali Fizli is back in politics and back in this position. It's so symbolic of the Syrian regime's return to Lebanon. That was what we were seeing back then. Marada lost a seat. It's a party that is associated with the Syrian regime as well, led by the Frangieh family. You can say they have one seat by Tony Frangieh or 2 seats if you count William Tau, their ally from Sharri. But their alliance is more electoral than it is like about everything or doesn't really situate William Tau in March 8 clearly because of this alliance. And another major thing is Prime Minister Miqati. He had Azam block in parliament, and now it's gone.
Four MPs reduced to nothing. Well, maybe one, but he really doesn't have anybody in parliament anymore. We were talking about this the other week, about how he was looked like he was expanding. He was running a list in Nakar as well as in North 2. And nobody won his list. The list that he was supporting in Tripoli got one candidate through. That was Karim Kabara, who doesn't really need Miqati. He's the son of Mohamed Kabara, who's, you know, this long-time big political figure in Tripoli, who allied previously with Saad Hariri, and now his son is running for his seat, and he allied with Miqati, at least to get on to be on the list. But I don't think that the Kabaras necessarily owe anything to Miqati. Maybe there's a deal there, but Miqati basically went from four MPs to either zero or one, depending on how you count it.
Yeah, and it's interesting that now we have a prime minister who's expected to return and who doesn't enjoy any parliamentary support. So where is his mandate? It's just simply the agreement between foreign powers and their local allies on someone who is not too, you know, biased to one side over another.
I don't think that Miqati losing, though, bears too much on the March 8th, March 14th thing, because Miqati really had moved a lot more towards the center. I think what is a bigger issue, if you're looking at March 8th versus March 14th, is, of course, the FPM. And they're not catastrophic loss or anything, but they got cut down to size in this election. In the last election, they had something like 26 MPs or 29, if you count Tashnag with them. And this time around, it seems as though their bloc is going to have probably 18. If they manage to get Tashnag to join them again, which there are rumors that that may not happen, but if they do manage, then there'll be 21, big, sizable bloc. It would be the largest bloc probably in parliament. But as it stands right now, they are only at probably 18. I see some reports of 17, but it looks like that's about the case. You're talking there about something like losing, you know, 8 seats.
Yeah. And a lot of these seats that were lost are closer to March 14 than they are to March 8, you know. Nahmat Frem is an example. Also, Michel Dahir is an example.
Michel Mouawad
for sure. But before we talk more in more detail about like the Christian representation thing, in terms of March 8 versus March 14, the discourse that was so dominant by media and by many analysts and pundits, etc., during the election results time was around how there's a sovereigntist majority. You know, that the March 8 lost its majority and the majority of new MPs are pro-sovereignty, meaning they are against Hezbollah's weapons. And everyone was trying to frame it this way. So Jad Ghusn made a little comment when he said it used to be March 8 versus March 14. Now they're trying to make it March 8 versus October 17. And it's very true. A lot of people from the March 14 bloc were actively and explicitly saying we should be electing the sovereigntists, even if they are not the best opposition people, like Mouawad or like Jmayil, etc. This is a very advanced kind of polarization happening. And there's a big elite in Lebanon that we talked about last time that has divorced the FPM, the Free Patriotic Movement, mainly because of its alliance with Hezbollah, and has joined the sovereigntist wave, which includes people like the LF on one side and includes Kataeb and the traditional March 14 figures or many traditional Christian families. And also, we don't know how many Change MPs subscribe to it, but a number of them have made clear statements against Hezbollah's weapons, and all of them agree that we need a common state-led defense system in Lebanon that is not, you know, up to one sect to defend the country. This is common among all of them. The discourse, though, it differs.
And I think this plays in, especially when we're talking about the FPM, which lost seats, versus the LF, which gained seats. This time around, the LF went from 15 seats last time around to looks like around 19 seats. If Tashnak doesn't join with the FPM to form a bloc, then it looks like the LF will be the largest bloc in parliament, which would give them a certain mandate. And they already do. They certainly seem to feel as though they have a mandate. They are claiming that basically they represent Christians. And the priority, the most important thing to do is to wage this battle for a sovereign Lebanon, as they call it.
Yeah, and one thing to remember here for context is that 17 years ago, Semir Jarjar was still in jail. The ELF was still a banned party and it could not practice its politics openly. So to come back in 17 years, I know it sounds like a big time, a long time, but this is not a long time for people to forget what happened in the past. Jarjar is not the most popular figure at all in Lebanon. It's not his thing. He does, however, have a huge grassroots presence, especially among working-class Christians, in many working-class Christian areas and in many rural Christian areas as well. So they have a very solid base, but this base has been renewed because since its revival, since its resurrection, the ELF has been a very institutionalized party in Lebanon, so way more similar to Hezbollah than to the Future Movement or Azm. Right now in these elections, we saw how institutions make a difference. Hezbollah, way more institutionally effective than Amal per se, got way more votes. ELF did amazing according to their own wishes because they're a pure Christian party. Remember that. ELF can only win Christian seats because they don't usually run on any other seats. So for a Christian party, they did very well. And then you have the PSP, which was actually surprisingly organized and effective in this election, distributing votes surgically. Look at the list in Shufan Alay. How the hell does Marwan Ahmadi get as many votes as Taymour Jumblat, you might wonder? Marwan Ahmadi is one of the least popular PSP officials.
He's not even technically in the PSP, but he is with them.
With them, yeah. He's a Jumblat associated figure. Marwan Ahmadi got 11,000 votes because literally everyone in my village who voted PSP voted Marwan Ahmadi almost. Every village was given one name. This is what PSP does every time, and this is how it distributes votes, and this is how it used to make sure that its Christian candidate, like Naami Taomi, for example, this is how he used to win every time. People wouldn't vote for Naami Taomi out of, they would vote for Wali Jumblat, but Wali Jumblat would tell them, instruct them, no, you have to vote for Naami Taomi in order for him to win. You see what I mean? So in this situation, we see that the parties that survived and benefited in a way from the last few years in terms of just to maintain its power or advance it are the most institutionalized parties. And even though it doesn't look like that from outside, some organizations like the PSP show a lot of, a certain amount of discipline and huge numbers of people available for the electoral machines. And they achieved electoral results this way.
And I remember we made this exact same point 4 years ago, talking about Hezbollah and the Lebanese forces of running just very disciplined campaigns and doing well from that. And history has repeated itself. Obviously, the PSP took note and they also ran a good on the ground, distribute the vote properly type campaign. Okay, so going back to FPM and LF, March 8th, the March 14th, I think that sort of brings us to a larger question, which is what happens now? How do all of these parties, it seems like there are so many different people, so many independents, so many small, tiny groups, how do they actually, once they get into parliament, do anything? Because there are several things that are coming up here. The first thing, obviously, is just the basics of, okay, there's a new parliament. That means they need to meet next week, most likely, and decide who is the speaker, who is the deputy speaker, who are the secretaries, who are the commissioners, all of these basic parliamentary roles. And as far as that goes, there does seem to be some question whether Birri will actually return. Now, obviously, conventional wisdom, of course, it's going to be Nabi Birri. And looking at the numbers, it seems he would have that support.
Because of the PSP, specifically. Because PSP is aligned with March 14. At the same time, when it comes to Nabih Birri, they totally diverge with everyone else because Wali Jumblat and Nabih Birri have a solid relationship. They would not shake that up until Birri dies. Absolutely not. It's a very main thing for Jumblat to have this solid ally in the state, and Birri is that guy.
And Jumblat runs at 8 or maybe 9 MPs in the incoming bloc, and that is a significant number. It can tip the scales.
Yeah, the forces that have said that they won't vote for Birri are the LF and the Change MPs. Every one of them.
I think Rifi also said.
Yeah, Rifi, who also allied with the LF in Tripoli, mentioned that he's not going to vote for Nabih Berri. I would imagine many ex-future Sunni MPs would take something like that stance if it works in terms of public opinion, etc. But in general, they're not relying on them for Berri to arrive. So if Hezbollah's main allies and Amal's main allies all vote for Nabih Berri, he's going to go through. And one thing to mention here is that there literally isn't any Shia MP in parliament who is not associated with Amal or Hezbollah except one guy, Jamil Sayed, who himself wants to be parliament speaker. But guess what? Not going to happen if Berri is still around. So, you know, there's absolutely no candidate, unless someone actually proposes the name of Jamil Sayed, there's not going to be any candidate to play that role. One potential MP would have been Wasif Haraki, a very famous figure in the change movement, but he didn't make it through the parliament, so we're not going to have any independent Shia MP.
Yeah, if you look at there are 27, by law, there are 27 Shiite MPs in parliament out of 128. That number is fixed. 13 of them are Hezbollah, 13 of them are Amal, and then you've got, as you said, Jamila Sayed as the last one. And the other interesting thing about this is Jamila Sayed is seen as being somewhat close to Syria, mm-hmm. right? Well, going back to what you were talking about before, about how Syrian candidates lost a lot in this election, that also applied to Jamila Sayed. He still got a seat, but his vote count, it was something like a third of what it yeah. had been in 2008. In 2018, he got, I think, north of 30,000 votes, which made him seem like a very big leader or potential, you know, parliament speaker in waiting. But mm-hmm. this time around, it seems as though a lot of people didn't go for him for whatever reason, and he was sidelined.
Yeah. And what we know is that he's been pretty consistent in defending Hezbollah, but not so much Berri, because he's trying to say, if I'm supportive of the resistance, doesn't mean I accept like corruption and Amal and stuff. So Jamil Sayed was trying to make a name for himself by being this kind of voice. And I think, 20,000 votes? Like, he lost 20,000 votes between last year and this time. And he still made it. Thank you. He still made it because he got like, 11,000 or something like that. And his list was overwhelmingly winning in that district. But who decided that Jamil Sayed should not get as many votes? You know, that remains a question, because we might have developments around the relationship between Hezbollah and the Syrian regime that people don't expect. And there is some talk about that, especially with the Syrian regime getting closer to the Gulf countries nowadays. So always these open questions around whether internal dynamics between Amal and Hezbollah will explode or become more visible in the future.
Right. And whatever the case is, though, bottom line, there isn't an alternative to Nabih Berri. So the real question here with any of these, you know, parliamentary positions is, I mean, the next one is the deputy speaker of parliament. And there's all sorts of rumors going around as to what that might look like or who might fill that role. I don't know that it's really that important who exactly is the deputy speaker of parliament. It probably matters more for just like having the title and the symbolism of it. Although you do get certain things being in the secretariat and making the decisions on laws and scheduling things and running things. So we'll see what goes on with that.
But the names that have been circulated are the usuals: Ghassan Hasbani from the LF, Elias Boussab from FPM. Both names have been floated around for deputy parliament speaker before. And a new name is Milham Khalaf. I don't know who's promoting this name, because Milham himself said, I'm not looking for any position, etc. But then why is media promoting his name? Why is everyone asking about a potential deal that makes it easier for Nabih Berri to win and get Milham Khalaf to be deputy parliament speaker? Now, there is a situation in which Milham Khalaf would take that spot, which is where they literally disagree on who should be the candidate and they settle for middle ground, especially given the limited jurisdiction and power of this position.
And this is actually a real possibility, because the LF is coming in basically saying, hey, we represent the Christians now, but the FPM is not ready to give up that title of being, you know, the representatives, the largest representatives of Christians in Lebanon. they may not be able to come to an agreement one over the other and may have to go to a third party like Khalaf.
Exactly.
But I think all of this is kind of child's play compared to looking beyond that to government formation.
Mm-hmm.
That's a much bigger deal. It has way more consequences on the ground. I think the parliamentary positions should be able to be dealt with relatively quickly. If they aren't able to come to an agreement quickly on parliament positions, then Lebanon's in for a world of hurt, because there's no way that they're going to be able to come to an agreement on other things in any sort of reasonable time frame. But assuming that they're able to take care of those parliamentary positions, then we also have, well, as of Saturday going into Sunday, Mikati's cabinet will become a caretaker cabinet. They won't be able to do any of the things that normal cabinets do. It will just be caretaker mode, which usually means not meeting and just issuing basic decisions that keep things going without presenting anything new. Obviously, the country is in a place where you actually do need a government that's actively working on solutions and reforms to get the country out of its economic crisis.
And Mikati might come back after the elections, right?
Well, I mean, that's what everybody thought. The whole idea was, okay, Mikati was going to come in, talk to the IMF, but mainly set up elections, and then probably he would be reappointed and form a new cabinet that would look a lot like the one that he has right now, and they would get to work. But I'm not sure that the situation is the same. As we talked about, Mikati doesn't have sort of his own bloc in parliament anymore, which cuts away at his legitimacy. And then in addition to that, you see this, insurgent sovereigntist force coming along, and all of a sudden we're hearing the name Nawaf Salem again as a potential prime minister designate,
who was a candidate supported previously by many, change movements, as well as the Lebanese forces officially naming him in one of the consultations. So it's not the first time that we hear his name. He's a judge in the International Court of Justice. And, he sounds like a very reasonable guy, etc. Nawaf Salem was thinking about running in these elections in order to kind of put himself out there, but then he decided against it. So we're not sure what other names might be floated around. We're not sure what the change bloc will be doing about this, because, if you support a certain candidate and rally people around it, sometimes the ruling forces have to respond to that in a way or another. Like, they have to say why they are not in favor of this candidate or another. So, say Nawaf Salem, what would the FPM's official position for rejecting this name be? Or would they just ignore it? But even if they cannot impose their prime minister, the Lebanese forces today will have a bigger say than before. And there is this, a huge question. Because we have two, big, large, almost equal Christian blocs in parliament, who's going to be in power? Who's going to be opposition? Are they going to be ruling together? Is that possible to be sharing power in one government?
I mean, this seems like such a hard nut to crack. Because if you're the LF, look at the LF, for instance. They resigned. They took their ministers out of cabinet after the October 17th revolution began. And they've been positioning themselves as opposition ever since. Now they are claiming to have won a very big victory. I don't think that they can just say, but we're going to sit in opposition now. We need to be at the table. But they're not going to be able to push everybody else out. They're going to have to sit at the table with Gibran Basile, with Hezbollah, if they want to be in government. And I mean, what's the point of getting all of these MPs if you're not able to actually have some effect on the governance of the country?
Yeah, and who are the allies of the Lebanese forces that share its interests and will push, for the Lebanese forces, for example, to be in power or actually in the opposition? It's not clear, because this depends on what your parliamentary mandate or parliamentary support is. For Hezbollah and FPM and Amal to be outside of government, no, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, and I think Nasrallah even indicated last night that Hezbollah was not interested in stepping outside of government at this point. So I think that's sort of a dead letter. You're not going to get Gibran Basile to step aside, most likely, because remember, his father-in-law is still the president of the country and still has to sign off on any government formation. And then looking even beyond that, as we mentioned in the last podcast, there's the other issue that Aung's term comes to an end at the end of October. So it's entirely possible where we see a situation where we have this new parliament ready to make change, but then the powers are unable to actually form a government or perhaps even elect a new president. And then we're in this insane situation that should not ever happen, total constitutional crisis, of where a caretaker cabinet maybe has to assume the role of the presidency, even though it's in caretaker status, or Aung's term has to get extended or something like that, or they do have to actually figure out a big deal that includes who the next president's going to be, what the government's going to look like, and it seems to me as though the country's a long ways away, or the elites, at least, are a long ways away from being able to figure that out.
Yeah, unfortunately, it doesn't look good. It doesn't look like there is great room for agreement among the parties that are most representative in parliament today. It's very difficult to imagine anything happening soon, any government formation happening soon. The economic situation is already getting worse, especially when it comes to the exchange rate kind of fluctuating again.
I changed money the other day for 30,000 to the dollar.
Yeah.
It's already down to those levels and it's expected to get worse.
Exactly. So who's going to be managing the situation? Who's going to be taking the blame? Probably no one, but who's going to be actually trying to do something about it? It's very hard to imagine LF and the FPM being together in power. At the same time, it's very difficult to imagine anything but a national unity government actually being formed out of.
Right, LF and FPM, they tried to do this before. They tried to work together through the Marab agreement, and that just fell to pieces. No one in the LF wants to deal with Gibran Basile.
I think it would have been better if one of the two sides, quote unquote, one of the two camps was really had a majority, because I only imagine that the lack of an active government during our worst economic crisis ever is not a good thing. And an army that is poor, you know, soldiers that are poor, policemen who are poor, it's not a good recipe for anything but civil conflict or division, etc. So it's worrying. It's very worrying. And if Hezbollah and the LF remain on this like kind of polarized dynamic of each one of them strongly attached to their foreign allies and building their political strategy around that, I don't see a way in which we can have any management of the situation in Lebanon anytime soon. And it might go, you know, in many directions.
Yeah, I mean, and really, if you look at what people are talking about, you know, it's really is this March 8th, March 14th, sovereignty versus Hezbollah's weapons. That's what a lot of people are talking about instead of, oh, EDL might run out of fuel and plunge the country into complete darkness. You know, like stuff that's on the ground that affects everyone.
Yeah. And like BDL's reserves, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where are we on those? We have no idea right now how much actual reserves we have. And if we run out of reserves, what do we do then? You know, are the warnings by Sharb el-Nahas about the potential use of the gold valid at that point? Maybe they will be. They are not today. They're not talked about seriously today, but they will be maybe in that situation because Lebanon will be desperate for any source of income. Will the IMF give us money without a government? No. Will the IMF give us money without conditional reforms? No. So you're expecting long months, probably a year of, you know, uncertainty in Lebanon, at least until a certain political deal, as you said, brings a new president, a new government, and this deal requires more than even Lebanese actors sitting together, probably requires some regional agreement.
I mean, given that assessment, it makes you wonder how excited should these newly elected MPs be to be getting into parliament at a time like this?
I agree. That's a very hard mission. If I could sit with all of them, I would tell them this. Polarization is inevitable in a time of crisis. So in a time of economic and financial collapse, and with the presence of sectarian forces trying to polarize people in two directions, you have no choice but to create a narrative that polarizes people in a different way. even if people are supportive of these political parties, it doesn't mean they're going to war with them. 13 MPs in parliament make taking specific actions and advancing a discourse that, for example, polarize people based on economic interests, because this will be the most relevant thing in the upcoming years, okay? So, for example, people who benefit from a certain policy versus people who don't benefit from it. The interests of the banks and the restructuring of the banking sector and how much will be paid back to the banks. The issue of taxation, the issue of even customs and tariffs. All of these things can be used in order to build alliances with the working class and the farmers and a lot of the producing middle class in Lebanon. That I think will be super necessary for any kind of like real impact in the political scene we have today. Otherwise, more of this March 8th, March 14th bullshit and absolutely nothing effective happening.
Maybe they'll solve the March 8th, March 14th thing this time around. Who knows?
Who knows?
Well, on that depressing look at the future, I think we have to wrap it up and end it there. This is the end of not only this episode, but also our limited series coming back looking at the elections. Nizar and I are going to take some time off and get some rest, first off, yeah. Especially you, Nizar.
it was not easy, to say the least.
Nizar, I really do appreciate you jumping in and doing all of the editing and producing that Susan used to do for us. You've been incredible. Thank you so much. Nizar's been basically putting in 90% of the work for this podcast.
No, that's not true. But yeah, it's been an incredible effort by both of us to be able to come back on top of things and prepare and actually record, because like people don't know that we sometimes take like 20 hours or 25 hours of prep actually before recording. But it's been really fun, no?
It has been a lot of fun, I have to say. I've had a lot of fun coming back and doing this. So
I guess we'll let you guys know about the future of the podcast after we take some time to rest, as you said.
All right. And on that note, I'm Benjamin Red.
I'm Nizar Hassan.
And this has been the Lebanese Politics Podcast. Bang, 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 bang. The Lebanese Politics Podcast is brought to you by me, Benjamin Red, Nizar Hassan, who also produces it, and the music was by Omar Al-Fil.